I'm Jim Werbel for KHOI Community Radio, and this is KHOI's Heart of Iowa, a program featuring a patchwork quilt of artists, public speakers, and individuals of note in Central Iowa. Welcome. Today we have Kay Puttick on the show. Kay Puttick is a producer here at KHOI, and she has also been a professor of world literature at Minnesota State University at Mankato. And she is an expert on D.H. Lawrence. So we will be talking a lot about D.H. Lawrence today, reading his poems, as well as exploring some of the history and his influence on Western literature.
And his life. He had a very interesting life.
He did have.
And it influenced his work very much.
He also lived during very interesting times.
Absolutely.
Which also made him a very interesting writer.
Mm-hmm.
So welcome, Kay.
Thank you, Jim. Thank you for asking me to do this. It's a pleasure to talk about D.H. Lawrence.
You don't get a chance to talk about D.H. Lawrence very often?
No. Not many people, I fear, read him nowadays, unfortunately. But they read his poetry, perhaps. But, he's considered a bit old-fashioned. I'm beginning to get the idea. And I didn't teach him much in the last years. I taught his short stories. But he's still worth reading. I mean, that's obviously, we wouldn't be doing this. We didn't think he's worth knowing about.
I'll say this, that I'm... For the show, I did more reading of his work than I've done, and I'm really impressed with what I've been reading. So it's some very exciting literature. How did you get interested in D.H. Lawrence, Kay?
When I was sort of about that age, sort of in high school and getting ready for college, he was quite a well-known writer, and he was very popular. But I first started reading him when I was an undergraduate, a freshman, as you'd say in America, my first year in college. He wasn't part of the assigned readings. I just read a lot anyway. And I thought, well, I'll start with Sons and Lovers. And I was reading that and, without wishing to sound gushy, I was absolutely overwhelmed by the beauty of the writing, the sort of intensity and the compassion of the relationships that were depicted there. And I thought, honestly, this is the best book I've ever read in my life.
Wow.
And I had this, I sort of made this vow that I've got to save this guy up. I mustn't read. My instinct would have been to read everything he'd written right then and there.
Mm-hmm.
I've got to save him and make him last.
Well, you made him last quite a while in your life because you wrote a dissertation in part on D.H.
It lasted many years, yes, and I did it. Write my doctoral dissertation on D.H. Lawrence and Virginia Woolf, the two of them, which I wouldn't advise anybody to do, to write it about two figures, because it's like writing two dissertations and you've somehow got to tie them together, which is much more complicated than I thought it was going to be. But I did notice, actually, I read Sons and Lovers, and then I read, I think, The Rainbow next, and Women in Love, and I was still saving up. But, of course, at that point, I had read what are still my favorite novels and are deservedly his most famous.
Okay.
So I think I've probably read all his novels, and he wrote masses of essays, two big volumes of essays, a lot of them published posthumously because they appeared ephemerae in newspapers and things.
Okay.
So I think I can say I've read everything he wrote. And you can see, Jim, how thick this, just his collected poems is. Mm-hmm. It's a great thick volume of his collected poems.
Okay.
They're still very interesting.
Well, let's start with what you like. Why don't we start off with one of his poems, and why don't you share one of his poems?
Right. Well, I thought we'd sort of talk about his work as it progressed through his life. And so sort of looking at this in a biographical way, this is a poem. It is about his early life. At least it's partly about his early life. It's a pretty famous poem called Piano.
Mm-hmm.
Now, many people know that D.H. Lawrence's father was a coal miner, a barely literate coal miner. And this family is depicted in Sons and Lovers. And there's a lot of quarreling between the parents in the novel Sons and Lovers, in the autobiographical novel Sons and Lovers. And it's pretty clear that, well, at least to an English person, maybe Americans aren't so used to thinking about class in quite this way, that one of the big problems between the parents is class difference.
Mm.
For example, the father comes home from the pub at night. He goes to the pub after he's come up from the mine. As his daughter said, Lawrence's sister said much later, my father wasn't very literate. He could barely read the newspaper. He used to go to the pub after work, mostly for company, and he'd come home slightly fuddled.
Mm-hmm. Inebriated.
Yeah, just slightly, drunk. But she said if my mother had just left him alone, everything would have been fine, but she would attack him with a stream of biting words. because he had, you know, he had given her the impression when they married that he was teetotal. He'd signed the pledge. And she just couldn't accept this reality of his.
And his mother's background was the class difference? Why, what was
Well, she had been a school teacher. She was sort of lower middle class, I suppose. Mm-hmm. She'd been an elementary school teacher, and she was a
Had some more education than
Yes,
the
and had sort of different standards. But anyway, there's no sign in Sons and Lovers. It's autobiographical, but it's fictionalized too.
Mm-hmm.
There's no sign in Sons and Lovers that his mother played the piano, for example. But she did. And this poem is called Piano, and the speaker is listening to, is at a concert, listening to a woman singing and playing the piano. And it carries him back to his past and his family. So the whole poem, it's about nostalgia. It's a nostalgic poem. But it gives a feeling of the intensity with which Lawrence experienced things and the intensity with which he remembered things and the love that he had for his background and his family. Piano. Softly in the dusk, a woman is singing to me, taking me back down the vista of years till I see a child sitting under the piano in the boom of the tingling strings and pressing the small poised feet of a mother who smiles as she sings. In spite of myself, the insidious mastery of song betrays me back till the heart of me weeps to belong to the old Sunday evenings at home, with winter outside and hymns in the cozy parlour, the tinkling piano our guide. So now it is vain for the singer to burst into clamour with the great black piano appassionato. The glamour of childish days is upon me. My manhood is cast down in the flood of remembrance. I weep like a child for the past.
Capture nostalgia. Yeah,
but why he's weeping is a little obscure. There's various ways to interpret that. Maybe he's weeping partly about the sorrow of the past, but certainly missing the past, I'd say. I think that's clear from the whole feeling of the poem.
Yeah, well, there's I believe the poem suggests the very childlike simplicity that never returns as we are adults.
Yeah, that too.
That's an example from D.H. Lawrence that was labeled Piano. So you're describing his early childhood a little bit, parents of different socioeconomic class.
Right, but Lawrence was born in 1885. And, you know, at that time, a woman, when she was married, didn't go out and earn a living or contribute to the family income. So she was dependent on her husband's wages, and they were very good for miners' wages. Mm-hmm. He was what is known as a butty. That is to say, he was in charge of a whole group of miners. He was, in fact, an underground contractor of miners. So he'd be in charge of paying the other miners in his stall, as they said, and he earned good pay. He was highly respected in the town. He was a highly skilled man. But his mother, with her sort of somewhat puritanical background, well, she seems to be teetotal, but it also describes in Sons and Lovers, it describes her brewing beer at home, which is rather strange.
Who knows? That may be accurate or maybe a part of the family or not a part of the family.
Well, it seems strange that she'd give him such a hard time for coming home. Yeah. I think the main problem, what I was sort of leading up to, is he was spending money that the family needed in the pub. I think that was the main problem.
Yeah. So why, if this is the class society and English, the upward mobility in England was very restricted at that time. How did D.H. Lawrence get out of the mine work?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, he was an extremely talented person. He won a scholarship to continue at high school and to go to college. His first real job was as a teacher.
Ah.
But he was a very talented man. One of the stories I love to tell is how Lawrence met his wife.
Mm-hmm.
This is all going to prove the point how talented he was and how obvious his talent was to other people. Lawrence had finished training as a teacher, but it had become clear that he had very weak lungs and was, in fact, prone to TB, which had killed him by the time he was 45. So he wanted to work abroad in a warmer climate. So he approached his old professor about getting a job in Germany. This man had...
Oh, warmer climate, Germany?
Well, on the continent. This man who was married to a German woman, knew the continent well, And Lawrence wanted to sort of see if he could get a job as a teacher on the continent.
Mm-hmm.
So this was sort of in the works, and then Lawrence sort of moved on to other things. He was invited to lunch at the professor's house, and because he'd sort of moved on a bit, he declined the invitation. He was thinking of other things. Then he got a notice from the professor's wife saying, please come to lunch. And as he said to friends, I couldn't refuse the lady. Now, this professor's wife became Lawrence's wife. They ran away together eventually.
Okay.
And we know now that the professor used to come home from classes where he'd been teaching Lawrence and say to his wife, there's a genius in my classes.
Mm.
And he was referring to Lawrence.
Mm-hmm.
And so when Mrs. Weekly at the time, Professor Weekly's wife, knew that this genius student was maybe coming to lunch, she encouraged him to come to lunch.
Hmm.
So that's how they met. So, yeah, everyone that knew him testifies to what a vibrant personality he was and how alive he was to everything and how bright he was. And apparently a very good teacher, too. I mentioned his first job was as a teacher. He was very good at that, too.
Falling in love with a professor's wife was, I suspect, not something to be aspired to in those, end of Victorian times. What kind of an impact did that have on him and his writing?
It was very hard on his marriage because his wife, from her former marriage, she had children.
Okay.
She ran away with Lawrence. She left the children behind.
Mm-hmm.
It was many years before she was allowed to see the children again. So all this was very hard on them.
Mm-hmm.
But the business of running away together, people, when they think about D.H. Lawrence, they think of him perhaps, I don't know, do they, as a...
a libertine.
Yeah, a libertine. In fact, one of my professors in graduate school, not a D.H. Lawrence special, she knew I was writing about D.H. Lawrence, and I was discussing Lawrence with her for some reason. And I said, he had a very serious attitude towards marriage. She said, well, how many wives did he have? And she didn't know. I said, he was married once, and that marriage lasted the whole of his life. I said, his wife had been married three times.
Mm-hmm.
She was married to the man before Lawrence Weekly. Then she was married to Lawrence, and after Lawrence died, she married again. So she had three husbands, but he had the one wife. And he was, I would say, in many respects, puritanical. He took sex very seriously. It was a serious business. It was a sacrament. Anyway, I'll just pursue this business about his marriage, if I may. As I say, he went to lunch there, and presumably this had been arranged specially. Professor Weekly hadn't appeared from wherever he was for the lunch, so it was Mrs. Weekly, the professor's wife. The windows were open, the French windows open onto the garden, and the children were playing outside, and Mrs. Weekly was sitting there, and Lawrence and Mrs. Weekly were talking before lunch, and they were chatting away. And they got to know one. And he began to talk about the book that he was working on, which was Sons and Lovers, this autobiographical novel.
Mm-hmm.
And this is an interesting point, too. Frieda, Lawrence's wife, said later, we spoke about Oedipus, and understanding leapt between our words. She introduced him to the idea of Freud and Oedipus complex and all that. He probably never heard of Freud at that point and never heard of the Oedipus complex. Hardly anyone in England had. Frieda Weekly, as she was then, had heard of Freud because she'd lived on the continent. In fact, she'd had an affair with one of Freud's disciples. She was quite a Freudian.
Mm-hmm.
So I would maintain that there's a sort of Freudian overlay in Sons and Lovers, which is perhaps shouldn't be taken too seriously. It's there partly because of his wife's influence and her theorizing. But anyway,
I know some people do Freudian overtones interpret D.H. Lawrence from a Freudian perspective, in part because he's not afraid to raise sexual issues, and because of that, Freud comes up.
Right. Yeah, well, also the relationship with his mother, she's clearly very close in Sons and Lovers, very close relationship. But I would maintain he identified with her. He identified in different ways with both his parents, and a marriage like the marriage between his parents is something he explored throughout his life. You can say that Lady Chatterley's Lover is another exploration of his parents' marriage. That's one way to look at it. It's a lady marrying a gamekeeper.
Okay, I get it.
So it's another angle. It's another way of looking at this. This is a way it could be successful, a marriage like this, maybe.
Huh.
You see, it's a lady marrying a gamekeeper. A lady marrying a coal miner whatever.
Yeah.
But he's exploring the same thing. He's using his work, you know, as thought experiments for himself. But anyway, going back to getting to know his wife and his puritanical, if you like, attitudes about sexual relationships and so on, Mrs. Weekly, as she was then, and Lawrence were getting to know one another. And at one point, when he was there visiting, and apparently Professor Weekly was not around, she said to him more or less, and we know all this because she wrote about it. She wrote about their lives. She said, you know, let's go upstairs. And he said, no, I will not deceive your husband like this. I will not do this behind your husband's back. If this is what you want, let's run away together. So that's just one example of what you might call his conscience.
Sense
his
of ethics and conscience,
sexual matters.
Yeah. So he's not as libertine as some people perceive him to be in his writing.
No, he's very frank about sex. He cared very much about sex. A lot of people say he's humorless about sex because he does take it so seriously. It's almost like a sacrament to him.
Interesting. Well, you are going to read a section of Sons and Lovers to us to describe some of his earlier work and describe a part of his life. So why don't you go ahead and read that section
right. And this is very interesting for a lot of reasons. It gives a glimpse of the vividness of his writing. It gives a glimpse of working class life and mining life. But it also, at the end, you get a very good sense of the relationship between the son and the mother here. And what a good mother she is in many respects. And that's something I want to emphasize. When people first read Sons and Lovers, when it first came out, nobody thought about Freud when it first came out. They all if you look at the early reviews, they sort of say, what a wonderful mother this is, how she battled with these difficult, this difficult situation with this drunk for a husband and blah, blah, blah. And they don't, you know, the Freudian thing didn't come into any of the critical approaches till people had learned, you know,
more
to look
about
at it that
Freud,
way.
Yeah.
Lawrence's father was a butty. That is to say, he was an underground employer of other miners.
Kind of a foreman-like character.
Yeah, a contractor.
Yeah.
And the butties would be given the pay for their whole store, for all the men in their store. And often they would send the kids to pick up the pay. And then they would distribute the pay later, either in the pub, often in the pub, or in their own homes. Mm-hmm. Well, in this occasion, the character Paul, who really is more or less the young D.H. Lawrence, the character Paul has been delegated by his family to pick up the money. So they're in the offices of the mining company. From inside came the cry, Spinney Park, Spinney Park. All the folk for Spinney Park trooped inside. When it was time for Bretty to be paid, Paul went in among the crowd. The pay room was quite small. The counter went across, dividing it into half. Behind the counter stood two men, Mr. Braithwaite and his clerk, or clerk, Mr. Winterbottom. Mr. Braithwaite was large, somewhat of a stern patriarch in appearance. Holiday, came the ringing voice of Mr. Braithwaite. Then Mrs. Holiday stepped silently forward, was paid, drew aside. Bower, John Bower, a boy, stepped to the counter. Mr. Braithwaite, large and irascible, glowered at him over his spectacles. John Bower, he repeated. It's me, said the boy. Why, you used to have a different nose than that, said glossy Mr. Winterbottom, peering over the counter. The people tittered, thinking of John Bower, senior. How is it your father's not come, said Braithwaite, in a large and magisterial voice. He's badly, piped the boy. You should tell him to keep off the drink, pronounced the great cashier. And never mind if he puts his foot through you, said a mocking voice from behind. All the men laughed. The large and important cashier looked down at the next sheet, and it goes on, and then finally young Paul steps up. So he steps forward, and then he's meant to give back, I don't know, the deductions for their use of tools. He's too flustered to count it out, and he just pushes forward some money, not the right amount. How much do you think you've given me? Asked Mr. Winterbottom. The boy looked at him, but said nothing. He had not the faintest notion. Haven't you got a tongue in your head? Paul bit his lip and pushed forward some more silver. Don't they teach you to count at the board school? He asked. Not but algebra and French, said a collier. And cheek and impudence, said another. Paul was keeping someone waiting. With trembling fingers, he got his money into the bag and slid out. But then he goes home in a terrible mood. Paul went home glowering. He entered the house silently. Friday was baking day, and there was usually a hot bun. His mother put it before him. Suddenly, he turned on her in a fury, his eyes flashing. I'm not going to the office any more, he said. Why, what's the matter? His mother asked in surprise. His sudden rages rather amused her. I'm not going any more, he declared. Oh, very well. Tell your father so. He chewed his bun as if he hated it. I'm not going to fetch the money. Then one of Carlin's children can go. They'll be glad enough for the sixpence, said Mrs. Morell. The sixpence was Paul's only income. It mostly went in buying birthday presents. But it was an income, and he treasured it. They can have it then, he said. I don't want it. Oh, very well, said his mother. But you needn't bully me about it. They're hateful and common and hateful they are, and I'm not going any more. Miss Braithwaite drops his H's, and Mr. Winterbottom says, you was. And is that why you won't go any more? Smiled Mrs. Morell. The boy was silent for some time. His face was pale, his eyes dark and furious. His mother moved about at her work, taking no notice of him. They always stand in front of me so I can't get out, he said. Well, my lad, you've only to ask them, she replied. And then Alfred Winterbottom says, what do they teach you at the board school? They never taught him much, said Mrs. Morell. That's a fact. Neither manners nor wit, and his cunning he was born with. So, in her own way, she soothed him.
Seemed like a very caring mother to
help
a rather explosive child going through a traumatic experience.
Yeah, I mean, it's very skillful, too. Mm-hmm. I mean, she's not taking it too seriously, and she's calming him down. And,
there's also a lot of humor in that writing
that you just read.
Yeah. And most people generally would not associate that with humor. And also, obviously, a lot of class issues going on,
sure,
including even pronunciation issues about dropping H's.
Right, exactly. Yeah. But even his mother, you notice, says, well, that's not really the problem, is it? Not that the problem that he says you was and drops his H's, that's not really what's bothering him.
Right. Yeah. Oh, okay, well, so D.H. Lawrence writes Sons and Lovers. It's one of his first major writings then, right?
Yes, it is, yeah.
And it's one of his more long-lasting ones as
mm-hmm,
well.
Mm-hmm. It's about his relationships with his family and then, of course, with the two women that, basically two women with whom he has sexual relationships. So he's, it's what used to be called a Bildungsroman, a story of a young man growing up and getting out ready for life. Mm-hmm. So that's what it is. But as I say, it's an incredibly vivid piece of writing. The thing that moved me so much, as I mentioned when I was an undergraduate, was you see the quarreling between these parents.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing that I noticed, there's these two people who are, decent people. And you see the sort of tragedy of this quarreling between them. And clearly the author cares about both of them. And it's just such a compassionate treatment of the whole conflict there.
Hmm. With an understanding and acceptance.
Yeah. Often when I say a lot of his essays were more ephemeral and more forgettable, it's because he would dash his essays often. But one of them, he wrote some very important essays about the nature of the novel as a form.
Hmm.
And he said things like, give me the novel, let me hear what the novel says. It's the one bright book of life. As for the novelist, he's usually a dribbling liar. In other words, I mean, he explains what he means. What a writer might say about his work is not necessarily the truth, because it's coming sort of from the top level of his conscious mind and what he's just heard say about Freud from his wife or from somebody else. But when he's actually writing about characters that he grows to care about, a kind of truth comes out that he might not be fully aware of. And that's very clear.
So D.H. Lawrence marries Frida, becomes the...
Yeah, it took them 2 years to get married. They ran away to the continent together. And eventually, Professor Wheatley did give Frida a divorce.
Okay. And so then they moved back to England, as I remember.
Eventually, yeah.
Eventually.
Yeah.
This is during World War One years.
Right. They met in 1912 and they married in 1914.
Oh, yeah. My. So German-English relationship.
Right. Well, yeah, Frieda Weekly, as she had been. Weekly was her married name. Her maiden name was von Richthofen, which might be familiar. The Red Baron was von Richthofen.
Okay.
He was a cousin.
All right.
So he, during World War One times, he's married to this woman who is a cousin of the Red Baron.
And they're living in England.
Well, at that, yeah, later. It's ironic, actually, because when they're in Germany, when they were on the continent, at one point when they're in Germany, they were suspected of being spies. This is before the war had broken out.
Okay.
Later, they're in England, and they're living in Cornwall, and they're suspected of being spies by the other side, because he's got a German wife. And they used to provoke the authorities. They lived on the coast, and, of course, who knew? They might have been signaling across the channel. And they used to be deliberately provoking. Like, they knew people were hanging around watching them, and they'd start singing German folk songs.
Okay, so...
Yeah, it's sort of funny in a way, but it was...
It was dangerous play.
It was dangerous, and it was sad, because when he came out with his next brilliant novel, The Rainbow... It was banned, and it wasn't really for sexual reasons. It was because Lawrence was basically a pacifist. He was against the war. He certainly was not a spy or anything like that. But it was for political reasons, that novel. So his sort of making fun of the authorities had, well, it probably would have happened anyway, but it had serious financial consequences for him.
So does they leave England then?
Eventually, yes. And he was glad to leave England because at that point he'd had such a horrible experience with being hassled as a spy. He was coming back from the village. They lived in this pretty remote cottage in Cornwall. He went to the village to buy some groceries. He was walking back. They stopped him and searched his bag and got out his groceries.
Oh, my.
And then he was called up. You know, his number came up for the draft.
Mm-hmm.
He was way too sick to be in the army. I mean, as I say, he was pre-tubercular. He probably had TB by that time. I'm not sure. Left England at that point during, I suppose, must have been after the war. He traveled a lot.
He did travel a lot.
Yeah.
He traveled through Europe, through India, Ceylon.
Right. And eventually, you might say, landed up in New Mexico.
Okay. Well, why don't you read us another one of his poems, kind of in his post-World War One literature?
Well, I thought we might read this poem together, Jim.
Okay, I'm game.
Because it needs two voices. This is a poem he wrote when he was living in Sicily, in a villa in Sicily. It's just called Snake. And it's on the surface, it's just about an autobiographical description of what happened when a snake came and drank out of his water supply there when he was living in this pretty primitive villa in Sicily. But it's about Lawrence's perennial themes, the separation of humankind from nature, which he deplored, including the dangerous aspects of nature. This is a poisonous snake, as it turned out. It's also about what Lawrence considered the bad impact of conventional religion, particularly Victorian Christianity, upon our relationship with the world and relationship with nature, and sort of tendency to think of snakes as evil and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And there's also references, most people think, to earlier traditions that revere and honor the natural world and honor even poisonous snakes.
Well, also I'll say Freudians always have fun with anything dealing with snakes.
Well, that's true, and they do with this one, but I was not going to go there. But. Now, there's two voices in this poem, and so I'll read part. They're both the voices of the same person, in a sense, but they're voices of different parts of his mind speaking.
An eagle and an alter ego.
Yeah. A snake came to my water trough on a hot, hot day, and I in pajamas for the heat, to drink there. In the deep, strange, scented shade of the great dark carob tree, I came down the steps with my pitcher, and must stand and wait, for there he was at the trough before me. He reached down from a fissure in the earth wall in the gloom, and trailed his yellow-brown slackness, soft-bellied down over the edge of the stone trough, and rested his throat upon the rim of the stone bottom. And where the water had dripped from the tap in a small clearness, he sipped with his straight mouth softly drank through his straight gums into his slack, long body, silently. He lifted his head from his drinking, as cattle do, and looked at me vaguely, as drinking cattle do, and flickered his two-forked tongue from his lips, and mused a moment, and stooped, and drank a little more, being earth-brown, earth-golden from the burning bowels of the earth, in the day of Sicilian July, with Etna smoking.
The voice of my education said to me, he must be killed, for in Sicily the black, black snakes are innocent and the gold are venomous. And voices in me said, if you're a man, you should take a stick and break him now and finish him off.
But I must confess how I liked him. How glad I was he had come like a guest in quiet to drink at my water trough and depart, peaceful, pacified, and thankless, into the burning bowels of the earth. Was it cowardice that I dared not kill him? Was it perversity that I longed to talk to him? Was it humility to feel so honored? I felt so honored.
And yet those voices. If you were not afraid, you would kill him.
And truly, I was afraid. I was most afraid. And even so, honored still more that he should seek my hospitality from out of the dark door of the secret earth. He drank enough and lifted his head dreamily as one who has drunken and flickered his tongue like forked night on the air, so black, seeming to lick his lips, and looked around like a god, unseeing, into the air, and slowly turned his head, and slowly, very slowly, as if thrice a dream, proceeded to draw his slow length curving round and climb the broken bank of my wall face.
And as he put his head into that dreadful hole, and as he slowly drew up, snake easing his shoulders and entered further, a sort of horror, a sort of protest against his withdrawing into that horrid black hole, and deliberately going into the blackness and slowly drawing himself after. Overcame me now, his back was turned. I looked around, I put down my pitcher, I picked up a clumsy log and threw it at the water trough with a clatter. I think it did not hit him, but suddenly that part of him that was left behind convulsed in undignified haste, writhed like lightning and was gone, into the black hole, the earth-lipped fissure in the wall front, at which the intense still noon I stared with fascination.
And immediately I regretted it. I thought, how paltry, how vulgar, what a mean act. I despised myself and the voices of my accursed human education. And I thought of the albatross, and I wished he would come back, my snake. For he seemed to me again like a king in exile, uncrowned in the underworld, now due to be crowned again. And so I missed my chance with one of the lords of life, and I have something to expiate, a pettiness. Now, that's probably one of his most famous poems, actually.
Well, he wasn't hesitant to deal with the topic of sexuality, but also, unbeknownst to this, people should be aware that he was also a great writer of class issues in England and portrayed those English.
Right. In fact, that, I would say, is one of his great legacies, his great legacy. He is the first writer to take British working-class life seriously from the inside. I'd say.
The very first one.
I think so, yeah. I mean, there's other people round about the same time who wrote, like H.G. Wells, who wrote about sort of lower middle class life. But that's sort of
wrote
about coal miners from the point of view of coal miners. Mm. Now, obviously, Dickens had written about working class life.
Right.
But not really from the inside.
Hmm.
Although Dickens, of course, had worked himself in a factory for a short mm-hmm. time as a child, so he did have a sort of personal experience. But it's not with the same feeling of belonging. This was something that Dickens felt outside of. Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, but Lawrence is writing about it from the inside.
And so this kind of opens up a different genre of writing to people where they can write not just about middle class values, which was the dominant theme, because most people were well educated who were writers. But this was somebody who then opens the doors for other people of different backgrounds to start writing about their experiences. And really, literature today does so much more, taking it from so many different perspectives.
Right, right. One of my professors, actually, in undergraduate school, in fact, a man named Richard Hoggart. He was one of the very, apparently impressed very people very much at the what's called the Trial of Lady Chatterley.
Mm-hmm.
The book Lady Chatterley's Lover was not published, at least in an official edition, as opposed to a pirated edition, mm-hmm. was not published in an English official edition, unexpurgated, until 1960.
Hmm.
Penguin Books published it then mm-hmm. because there'd been a change in the pornography laws, which they believed they could now do this mm-hmm. because the laws said something to the effect of, you have to judge the work as a whole, its literary merit as a whole, not just to pick out certain passages.
And it was banned because of a few select words, which I won't repeat at this time.
Yes. Well, basically, the book uses Anglo-Saxon words for the human anatomy and sexual act. And instead of saying vagina and sexual intercourse, which are Latinate words from the Latin language, it uses the words of Anglo-Saxon origin, which I still shouldn't say on the air, although there's nothing wrong with these words as such when they're used as they were used by Lawrence to refer to something very specific. But the trouble with these words is they're used as terms of abuse.
Mm-hmm.
So they have become...
They're usually derogatory terms.
Yeah, they're used as... Yeah. But as they're used in that book, they're not derogatory. They're used in a clean way, you might say. But as I was saying, my professor, Richard Hoggart, was one of the witnesses for the defense of this book, mm-hmm. Lady Chatterley, saying it's not an obscene book. Richard Hoggart was a man of working class origin. And he claimed, not at the trial, but I was talking to him years later. He said that when he first read Sons and Lovers, there was something about the style as soon as he opened it that sounded to him like the way people used to talk at home.
Huh.
Rather than what he was used to reading in books. A direct sort of what he thought of as a working class style of mm-hmm. talking or writing in this case.
Yeah, I've also noticed the directness to his writing. I'm thinking of somebody like Henry James who could be rather read at times if you've read.
Well, Lawrence can be very flowery indeed too, especially when it's describing sexual matters. The interesting thing actually about Lady Chatterley's Lover, if you look at the descriptions of sex, they're all from the female's point of view. It's mm-hmm. like what's going on in the woman's head. And of course, the important point to emphasize here is that Lawrence was deliberate. He was being a preacher, you might say, against Victorianism and the feeling that there's something nasty about sex.
Yes.
He was saying, no, there isn't anything nasty about sex. And in fact, it was his publishers, Garnet, said to him, I'm still waiting for a book from you that actually describes sex in detail. So that's what he did with Lady Chatterley's Lover.
I have to chime in here. Pornography was running rampant during Victorian times.
Of course it was. Real pornography.
Real pornography.
Yeah, right, exactly. But I have to tell you something about Lady Chatterley's Lover, actually. This is just a little anecdote, which is kind of amusing. When my son was about, I don't know, like pre-adolescent, 10, 11, 12, around about that age, he went off to stay for a week or two in the summer with an old friend of his, that he'd known from before we moved. And he came back and he was in this sort of, I'm going to shock my mother mood. And mm-hmm. he said, when I was staying with Lee, they've got a VCR and we watched this movie, Mum, Lady Chatterley's Love. he didn't even get the name right, Lady Chatterley's Love. Do you know that, Mum? And I said, yes. In fact, I wrote my PhD about it. And his jaw, talk about one up, his jaw dropped. And he said, you got a PhD for writing about that. So I enjoyed that.
Okay. I know that some people have questioned D.H. Lawrence for being, anti-feminist. One could argue, I suspect, some of his word choice in something like Lady Chatterley's Lover, which taking these Anglo-Saxon words.
Oh, no. I mean, I think they used very lovingly there.
Okay.
I
mean, but one could argue, I'm just saying.
No, not because of that, I don't think.
Okay.
In fact, in Sons and Lovers, it's a very small incident, but one of the women he has an affair with at the end is, in fact, a feminist.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she's interested in the suffragist movement, the women's suffragist movement. And she and the character Paul, who's the, do sort of argue about this.
Okay.
And he says, I would be a knight for the WSPU, Women's Social and Political Union, mm-hmm. which is a, and he said, I will carry your banner of white and green and heliotrope. And he's sort of teasing her and he's saying, I would be on your side in this. But yeah, the relationship between men and women in his works, there's no doubt about it. They're fraught.
Okay.
Starting with his parents, the characters in the novel The Rainbow mm-hmm. and Women in Love, they always seem to be quarreling.
There's tensions.
Right.
And there's tensions in his marriage, too, as well.
Oh, absolutely. And Lawrence's wife, Frieda, she said something along the lines of, oh, I think Lawrence's problem was that he believed women were more powerful than men.
Which really?
In her case, of course she was. In a sense, she was pretty
yeah.
robust.
Okay.
She lived much longer than he did.
Yeah.
And she was very sure of herself. So she was not intimidated by him. But things used to get pretty rough between them, yeah.
Okay. Well, things are changing, and he's eventually coming to the United States and spends a short time in the United States, very short time in the New World. Why don't you read us another poem, and we'll talk about his stay in the United States. This is your host, Jim Werbel. I've been talking with Kay Puttick about D.H. Lawrence, and we're reading some poetry and some of his words, as well as discussing his life.
Okay, I've chosen here, Jim, a poem, or part of a poem, called Tortoise Shout.
Mm-hmm.
This is another one of his animal poems.
Okay, nature.
It begins, I thought he was dumb, I said he was dumb, yet I've heard him cry. That's how the poem begins. The he being the tortoise. You know, one of these great, big, huge, mm-hmm. I don't know, I imagine it, the tortoise on the Galapagos Islands
yeah.
or something
okay.
like that, or out in the desert, one of these huge tortoises with a huge shell. Becomes clear when you read the poem, the tortoise does make a noise when it has sex.
Okay.
It screams. And he's talking about them. And, of course, if you try to imagine tortoises having sex, which he describes, the male tortoise has to stretch over the back of
yeah.
the female tortoise. And, of course, what it also has to do, it has to come out of its shell. And that's mm-hmm. the metaphor or the symbol or whatever. Coming out of your shell and making yourself vulnerable when you're having intercourse with another being. And then he takes this idea of the shout of vulnerability, which, you know, was sex. But then he just goes on. And there's this beautiful passage. The whole poem is much too long to read the whole thing. But I'll just read this passage about shouting. He's just remembering different kinds of noises that represent life with a capital L, you might say, life and vulnerability and the glory and the tragedy of life.
Okay.
I remember when I was a boy, I heard the scream of a frog, which was caught with his foot in the mouth of an upstarting snake. I remember when I first heard bullfrogs break into sound in the spring. I remember hearing a wild goose out of the throat of the night cry loudly beyond the lake of waters. I remember the first time, out of a bush in the darkness, a nightingale's piercing cries and gurgles startled the depths of my soul. I remember the scream of a rabbit as I went through a wood at midnight. I remember the heifer in her heat, blorting and blorting through the hours, persistent and irrepressible. I remember my first terror hearing the howl of weird, amorous cats. I have to interrupt here a minute there because not many people have heard the howl of weird, amorous cats nowadays. You don't hear cats outside.
Yeah.
They used to do it on the roof, as I recall, having sex. But it is a weird noise. I remember the scream of a terrified, injured horse, the sheet lightning, and running away from the sound of a woman in labor, something like an owl wooing. And listening inwardly to the first bleat of a lamb, the first wail of an infant, and my mother singing to herself, and the first tenor singing of the passionate throat of a young collier who has long since drunk himself to death.
Hmm.
So those are some of the sounds of life in the poem Tortoise Shout.
Again, just intense memory experiences. Mm-hmm. He strikes me as a, like any poet, just someone who has lives life intensely. So he travels the world, I know.
And writes about it.
He writes about his experiences. And how does he get to the United States?
Well, I know how he gets to New Mexico and why he settles in New Mexico. And that is because the patron of the arts, Mabel Dodge Lewin, who lived in New Mexico and who's still quite famous in New Mexico. There's a Mabel Dodge Lewin house, which is a B&B. She basically wooed him to come to New Mexico. Said this is a place that would interest you. It was good for his lungs, obviously. It was good for someone that had TB. And she said, the Indian, they didn't use the term Native Americans, and the Indians here are rainmakers. You know, she was sort of appealing to primitive, sort of his interest in, quote, so-called primitive life. And that's why he came to New Mexico. And she did, in fact, give not Lawrence himself, but his wife, a ranch in Mexico, which you can still, which now belongs to the University of New Mexico at Albuquerque. She wanted to give it to Lawrence. Lawrence was puritanical about property, as about me. He said he didn't want to own anything.
Okay.
Easy to say. So she gave it to his wife. So that was then Frida's ranch. And Lawrence still wasn't happy with this, so he gave the manuscript of Sons and Lovers in payment for the ranch, which turned out to be more valuable than the ranch.
Okay, I would think so. Now, Mabel Dodge brought together, there are a lot of famous Taos graphic artists as well as early writers, and so she did a lot to turn Taos into an artist colony.
Right, and actually, here's another example of Lawrence's puritanism. Apparently, I've never been to Mabel Dodge Lewin's house yet. I intend to go sometime, but apparently, right on the top is what you might call a sort of lookout, and it's glass. Well, a lot of people like to soak in the tub and look out, and Mabel Dodge was one of them. She had her bathtub up there on the roof.
Okay.
Well, apparently, it was possible sometimes to see Mabel Dodge in the altogether. And this offended Lauren.
Oh, my.
Yeah. Okay. So he went up there, and obviously, I suppose with her permission, because she never cleaned it off or anything. Yeah. He went up there and he painted it all over the glass. You know, beautiful paintings, apparently. But so that you wouldn't see Mabel Dodge.
Okay.
With nothing on. Now, so it was all right to do paintings of people with nothing on, but you shouldn't really see.
Interesting.
So, and apparently those paintings are still there on the roof. Yeah, and when Lawrence first got to New Mexico, he wrote about it afterwards. He said, when I first saw New Mexico, something stood still in my soul. He was very impressed with the landscape in New Mexico.
Let me describe an essay that he wrote. I found this on my own, and I'd like to share it with you with a little bit of New Mexico. As he said, he's traveled all over the world. As a matter of fact, our great-grandfathers, who never went anywhere, in actuality, had more experience of the world than we have who have seen everything. When they listened to a lecture with Lantern's Lies, they really held their breath before the unknown as they sat in the village schoolroom. We bowling along in a rickshaw in Ceylon say to ourselves, oh, it's very much what you'd expect. We really know it all. We are mistaken. The know-it-all state of the mind is just the result of being outside the mucus paper wrapping of civilization. Underneath is everything we don't know and are afraid of knowing. I realized this with shattering force when I went to New Mexico. New Mexico, wrapped in absolutely hygienic and shiny mucus paper of our trite civilization. That is the New Mexico known to most Americans who know it at all. But to break through the shiny, sterilized wrapping and actually touch the country, and you'll never be the same again.
Wow. That's quite a phrase, mucus paper wrapping.
So this is one of his travel writings that he writes, he fell in love with New Mexico. There was a type of earth-based experience that he had. Also, he fell in love with the dancing of the Native Americans, and was shaken by the dancing that they did, and the the primitiveness, so to speak, of the dancing, the authenticness of the dancing.
Right. Authentic is probably a better word. Primitive wasn't a bad word for him. It was an honorific.
Right. He travels to New Mexico, and he joins for a short period of time a colony of writers in New Mexico.
Well, he tried to get a colony of people to come and join him there.
Mm-hmm.
He went back to England. He had a dinner party at a famous restaurant, I forget the name, anyway. And he sort of ended with a plea, you know, come join me in New Mexico. And only one person actually took him up on it, which is not surprising. Yeah. I mean, they should throw up their lives. The painter Dorothy Brett. She did go and live there with Frida and Lawrence and remained there after he died. That was her home ever afterwards. He, of course, he's buried there, his ashes are buried there.
Mm-hmm.
Although he did not die there. He traveled back to Europe, and his TB got very bad, and he was too sick to travel. He couldn't travel. It's pretty tragic, actually, his last days. He died in a place called, I suppose it's pronounced Vence, V-E-N-C-E, in France.
Mm-hmm.
He and his wife were staying in various places. He wanted to get back to New Mexico. He was really too sick.
Mm-hmm.
And what would happen, they'd stay in some place, some hotel or something, and the next morning they'd be asked to leave because they'd hear this man coughing all night. And, of course, people were so afraid of TB in those days. They say you can't stay here, and they'd have to move on.
Hmm.
So it was pretty tragic. If he'd been able to get to New Mexico, his life might have been prolonged, but he did die there. He was buried there. And later he was exhumed, and his wife took his ashes back to New Mexico, where they call it a shrine, actually. There's a building to house his ashes.
We're not especially a religious person, but still a shrine is appropriate to describe that. Well, you have one final poem that shares with him that he wrote near the end of his life.
Well, some of his best poems were collected, his so-called last poems, the poem that he wrote while he was dying. And they are about dying, which sounds unpleasant, but they are very, very great poems. This is a poem called Lord's Prayer, which uses some of the language of the Lord's Prayer, Our Father, the Christian Lord's Prayer. And so in this prayer, in this poem, it's sort of a prayer, we hear the apostle of the body, Lawrence, when his own body was failing him.
Mm-hmm.
You hear in this poem also an assertive, arrogant individualism. At the same time, kind of humility, seeing himself not, as we might say, as a little lower than the angels, you know, that's a sort of Christian way to put it, but as a little lower, perhaps, than a goose or a fox. We also hear a poignant cry for a kind of immortality. I should mention, he uses this word mana in the last stanza, which is spelt with one N, M-A-N-A. So this is not referring to mana in the wilderness that you hear in the Old Testament. This is a word that he got from Polynesia. And as far as I can make out, it's from Polynesian religion. It's sort of more or less equivalent to the soul or immortality.
Okay.
More or less. Weird word at the end there. Lord's Prayer. For thine is the kingdom, the power, and the glory. Hallowed be thy name, then, thou who art nameless. Give me, O give me, besides my daily bread, my kingdom, my power, and my glory. All things that turn to thee have their kingdom, their power, and their glory. Like the kingdom of the nightingale at twilight, whose power and glory I have often heard and felt. Like the kingdom of the fox in the dark, yapping in his power and his glory, which is death to the goose. Like the power and the glory of the goose in the mist, honking over the lake, and I, a naked man, calling to thee for my mana, my kingdom, my power, and my glory.
Takes the Lord's Prayer and turns it a little topsy-turvy, doesn't it?
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
A Christian would say it would be sacrilege, but other people would say this is a person of deep spirituality.
Yeah, right. I'd say the latter, yeah. But sure, you could say it's blasphemous or heretical,
And this was one of his final, near the end of his...
Right. Not the most famous one, in fact, but one I like very much. Mm-hmm. Yes.
So you've been studying D.H. Lawrence. We've been talking about his impact on English literature. You mentioned that he writes about working class life from a very direct experience. He's a part of the people, the movement of people that acute observers of nature. Even in this last poem, he's bringing in animals and
right.
in that, which is a long tradition, but he still follows that tradition.
Right, right, in a very heartfelt way. Yeah.
Very heartfelt.
Yeah, and that's one of the marked parts in Sons and Lovers, the people getting out of the sort of out of the mining village, really, mm-hmm. and out into the countryside.
He did write openly about sexuality, wasn't afraid to do it in. Some people might consider it pornographic. Most people would.
No, it's nothing compared to what people used to.
It's nothing compared to Victorian pornography.
And it's nothing compared to what people regard as ordinary writing nowadays,
yeah.
descriptions of sex. It's nothing compared
yeah.
to that. It's very poetic and obscure, actually, and very metaphorical. I mean, he doesn't get down into specifics of
there's more sex in some romance novels.
Probably.
D.H. Lawrence. Finally, he just experienced life deeply, and what he wrote honestly.
Partly, perhaps, because he knew his life was going to be short. You know, it was sort of a death sentence to have TB in those days. So while he was alive, he experienced it very deeply. Yes, and wrote about it and shared it with us. So.
Mm-hmm. We've been talking to Kay Puttick about D.H. Lawrence. We've been sharing some of his writings with the listener. Hopefully the listener will pick up some of these writings. This is Jim Werbel again, saying that this has been The Heart of Iowa, a show, and goodbye until next time.